Welcome to In-Depth, an in-depth look at the interesting, educational, and timely topics affecting you right here in Marion County and beyond. The one to count on for today's local news coverage is KNIA KRLS. And now with today's In-Depth, here is Dr. Bob Leonard.
Did you know that Marion County was home to an Iowa Civil War governor? That he was a friend of Abraham Lincoln? That he was there at the birth of the Republican Party? And that his words on the convention floor may have led Lincoln to the Republican nomination and the presidency? If you didn't, and maybe even if you did, it's time to learn more about Governor William Milo Stone of Knoxville. Let's go in depth with Jeffrey Burden, Civil War historian and author from Richmond, Virginia.
Jeffrey, how did you become interested in Iowa Civil War history?
Iowa Civil War history was a little bit later on. As long as I can remember, to the earliest days of my schooling, I had interest in history and American history and even a focus on Civil War history. I learned in my 20s that I had a number of relatives who had served in the Civil War in a couple of different Iowa regiments, which kind of sparked and kicked off a particular interest. Of course, attending law school and now living in Richmond, Virginia, kind of also piques the interest of a Civil War enthusiast. It's around us all the time and a constant topic of conversation. But my own particular interest, of course, in Iowa Civil War history was initially focused on these individuals I was related to, and then that grows into a larger, as it often does, into a larger kind of interest in exploration and a larger kind of approach to studying the war in general, and in particular its effect on Iowa. In 2006, I began a project to edit and eventually publish what had been the unpublished regimental history of the 22nd Iowa Infantry that was published in 2008. So, in the course of that work, of course, then immediately everything's magnified and an even more intense level of study and interest. So it's been a long journey, but it's been interesting and certainly has led to a kind of a focus on and a particular interest in Iowa units in general and this particular unit in particular, the 22nd Iowa.
What can you tell us about Governor William Stone, who is from Knoxville?
He is one of the really, I think, compelling kind of characters of the war. In many ways, his story is not an untypical story from a man of that generation and time. He's a native of New York, and over time, by dint of hard work and ambition and desire, he turns himself into a figure of regional and even national interest. His story, as I say, is not untypical. He's born and spends his early life in New York State. He moves with his family to Ohio, seeking a better life and more opportunity. At some point thereafter, he's working there in Ohio. Decides that he's doing apprentice work as a chair maker. He comes under the influence of a lawyer in Ohio who likes Stone's kind of aggressiveness and intellect and ambition, invites him into his law office to read the law, which was, of course, the way most of lawyers train, not by attending school, but by working in a lawyer's office. This is later Judge Matthews. He does well. He's admitted to the Ohio bar in 1851. He goes into partnership with Matthews, and then all of them, Matthews and Stone's family, decide there's opportunity in Iowa. So in 1854, they move to Knoxville. So at there, Stone continues to kind of work under Matthews' tutelage, and their practice becomes rather successful. At this time, interestingly, not long after arriving in Iowa, Stone decides he's interested in newspaper work. He wants to have a voice in the community. So he brings a press in and begins to publish the Valley Whig and Keokuk Register. And also shortly after that, actually, that's the press that he bought. Then he brings it into town and begins to publish the Knoxville Journal on the press that had been the Valley Whig and Keokuk Register. Now, one of the issues that he's dealing with is the slavery issue. This is obviously a topic that's dominating the press, and he, though not strictly speaking an abolitionist, is certainly anti-slavery for many of the reasons Iowans were in those days, including the threat that slave labor presented to free labor. And so he begins to agitate on that issue in the press. One of the things that this leads to is he becomes one of the early leaders in the Republican, the Republican Party that's being born at that time. As the Whig Party collapses, this newly formed Republican Party becomes more and more prominent. He's one of the early leaders in Iowa of the Republican, this new Republican Party.
And why did they emerge? What were some of the principles that drove them?
Well, this was, as I say, kind of out of the wreckage of the old Whig Party, which had commitment to internal improvements and a federal interest in creating internal improvements and canals and waterways and roads, and also a commitment to free labor, to suppress slave labor, keep it where it was, so that free white laborers were not in competition with it. This became a particular rallying cry for this new Republican Party. Stone fell in line with that. Whether or not Republicans were all in favor of the abolition of slavery, it's a little bit different question. And not, of course, it wasn't a universal feeling in the Republican Party. That certainly was not what Stone was agitating for. There were abolitionist segments within society in general and the Republican Party particularly. But this is setting up the Republicans in opposition to Democrats, including particularly Southern Democrats, who were not as forceful on that slavery issue. Stone is a delegate to the first Iowa State Republican Convention in early 1856. He campaigns for Republican candidates that fall, and begins to make a name for himself as one of the early leaders of that party. Also, his law practice is doing very well at that time. And in 1857, he's made a judge. Iowa State judge. So, he's rising in the ranks of the community in Iowa, becoming a person of some prominence and influence.
And then he ended up pulling together a regiment of Iowans to go to fight the Civil War.
Absolutely. I mean, he goes on as a judge, and there's an interesting story that. You know, he's in court in session one day, and the word comes in of the firing on Fort Sumter in April 1861, and he's quoted as saying, "Gentlemen, Fort Sumter has been fired upon. This court stands adjourned until this matter is adjusted. By God, I'm going to war." Walked out of the courtroom and left to raise a company of men. Eventually found its home in the 3rd Iowa Infantry, a company being a unit of about 100 men. Typically 10 companies would form a regiment like the 3rd Iowa Infantry Regiment, and he began his career with basically no military training at all. Not at all unusual for prominent men to raise groups of men for service and even command regiments with no military training, and that could lead to its own problems, but Stone, a man of some intelligence and adaptability, was able to take that on.
And this pronouncement that he made was made in Knoxville.
Actually, when he said that, he would travel a circuit within his judicial circuit. He was actually in Washington County when that incident happened, where he learned of the attack on Fort Sumter and his declaration that he was going to war. He returned to Knoxville after that.
I see. And his troops, where were they from? Were they from the Marion County area?
They were. He requested and received permission from Governor Samuel Kirkwood to raise the company of men from the Knoxville area, and it became Company B of the 3rd Iowa Infantry.
Wow. And so how many men went with him?
Well, there were about 100 men in the company. Yeah, that was typically the strength of a regimental company. And that 10 of those would get together to have a regiment of about 1,000 men at the beginning who would form a regiment. Now, of course, right away you begin to have illness and desertions, and the number drops fairly quickly once a regiment enters active service. But you'd start out typically with about 1,000 men in the regiment.
Did they fight in any major battles?
They did, and this is part of where we see Stone's rise to prominence is continued. Again, he's a man with no formal military training, but he's intelligent and adaptable, and he actually makes quite a name for himself. The 3rd Iowa, he goes from being a captain of a company to an officer at the regimental level, a major, shortly after entering the service, which means he has responsibilities for the regiment as a whole. The 3rd Iowa ends up doing some skirmishing in Missouri and then getting involved in a fairly relatively large action at Blue Mills, Missouri, in September 1861. Stone's wounded there, and he spends most of the rest of that winter and early spring back home recovering from his wound. He gets back to the 3rd Iowa in late winter, and basically just in time to go with the regiment to Shiloh. Of course, the early, very famous, very bloody battle General Grant fought in Tennessee. And there, this is kind of the next step in his story. Stone is actually captured in the fighting there. The 3rd Iowa was among several Iowa units that performed quite heroically at that battle, made quite a name for Iowa troops in general in the war. Stone is captured. Now, he's taken down to Selma, Alabama, along with a number of other troops. Of course, the officers are segregated from the enlisted men. At this point, there still are quite a number of exchanges going on. The Union and Confederate governments would enter into formal negotiations and do a formal exchange of prisoners, basically one officer for one officer, a certain number of enlisted men for a like number of enlisted men. But you have to arrange that. Now, Confederate General Beauregard gives permission for 3 of the officers down in Selma to go up to Washington to negotiate the exchange. Stone is one of those 3 officers. They go up to Washington. Now they've given their word of honor that they're on a mission with permission and that they'll return if the negotiations are unsuccessful. They haven't been exchanged yet. The negotiations are not successful. Stone returns to Richmond, turns himself in per his promise. Of course, this impresses the Confederate leadership, including Jefferson Davis, President Davis. He sends Stone and the other men back up to try again, at which time they're successful. They make the arrangements for this exchange, and eventually Stone is exchanged and is able to resume his career with the Union armies, and he returns to Knoxville.
Wow. Now, you mentioned his part in the formation of the Republican Party. Would it be honest to say that some of the intellectual roots of the Republican Party were from him?
You know, that's an interesting question. He's not recorded as being a kind of a provider of what you say the intellectual roots. This is an interesting quote from a fellow named Alan Schroeder, who worked for the Iowa State Historical Department, and about 30 years ago wrote one of the better brief biographical sketches of Stone. His kind of summary here, and I'll read it in terms of who Stone was this, and I'm quoting here: "More of an expert political opportunist than a great statesman or political philosopher, Stone had a talent for finding out which direction most of the people were moving, then rushing out ahead to lead them. This talent does not produce innovative political philosophies or radical new social movements, but it does provide leadership of a sort, and it can lead to a successful political career." End quote. So while that's kind of damning with faint praise, I tend to think that does get at the truth of Stone's career. I don't think he provided the intellectual underpinnings for the movement, but he provided some of the vigor and some of the strength that helped establish the Republican Party, certainly in Iowa, and helped it grow to prominence, and of course then worked into the success of the party in 1860 when Abraham Lincoln was elected.
Well, tell us about his relationship with Lincoln.
Well, as an early leader of the party, he certainly was someone who knew Lincoln, at least by reputation, and the record's pretty clear that by the time Lincoln's running and by the time Lincoln's the Republican convention is coming up in 1860, he's a Lincoln supporter. You know, one of the great stories from that convention, and it shadows some things that happened later, which we'll talk about, but this ability that Alan Schroeder just mentioned to kind of jump out in front of the crowd and lead it. At one point during the convention, after Lincoln's nomination, and there's some tumult, and it's still kind of unclear what's going to happen, Stone leaps up and says, "Mr. President, I rise in the name of two-thirds of the delegation from Iowa to second the nomination of Abraham Lincoln." Now, actually, he wasn't speaking for the majority of the delegation. Most of the delegates from Iowa were not supporting Lincoln at that point. So he stretched the truth a little bit. But this dramatic statement at a critical point tended to galvanize the rest of the convention and help kind of lead the way towards all of the other parties coalescing around Lincoln, other delegates from other states, and certainly the Iowa delegation. An example of Stone sensing where things were headed and having the wherewithal and the confidence, the chutzpah, one might say, to jump up and take the bull by the horns and try to force the matter.
Well, it's intriguing to think what might have happened if he wouldn't have jumped up and said that.
Well, it might have gone on. It might have taken longer. Who knows? Exactly right. You know, where do things go if the convention remains in a state of tumult and discussion and argument back and forth? But he helped focus and sharpen the issue, and certainly helped to force the issue at that point. And Lincoln knew this. Lincoln knew what happened. He remembered that, so that it was the beginning of a friendship of sorts. Certainly politically speaking, between Lincoln and Stone. If I may, we were talking about his military career, what I would like to do is kind of circle back to that.
Sure.
If I may.
Of course.
Because it leads into the rest of the political story as well, certainly. When we left off, Stone had returned to Knoxville after his exchange. He cannot serve again until all the paperwork's done on this exchange. I mean, all the legal niceties have to be observed, and the paperwork has to be filed. Until then, he cannot serve actively in the field. If he were captured before being formally and officially exchanged, he'd be subject to execution. So it's by the Confederate forces. So it's a nicety he's got to observe. While he's waiting, and all this notoriety, and he's a wounded war hero, helped organize a prisoner exchange, he is made, named the colonel of the 22nd Iowa Infantry. Now, this was not because of any relation particularly to that regiment as it was raised. The 22nd Iowa was intended to be a Johnson County regiment. It was intended to be composed entirely of men from Johnson County, Iowa City. They couldn't quite do it. They had to recruit three of the 10 companies from other three other counties, but it was mostly Johnson County men. Here a fellow from Marion County was named colonel of the regiment. Not entirely popular decision among the men who were serving in the 22nd. There is some suggestion again in the regimental history that I edited and published a couple years ago. The writer, who was a friend of Stone's and a fan of Stone's, mentions that there was some dissatisfaction within the regiment, and there were officers in the regiment who were not happy with Stone and were working against him. Be that as it may, he's named the colonel. Eventually, the paperwork gets done on his exchange. In November 1862, he actually joins the regiment in the field. By that point, they're down in central Missouri. Now, again, here we see an interesting... He's a personable guy, And there are those men who were in the regiment who wrote about it in later years talked about, interestingly, some of the same anecdotes of his service. You know, at one point he learns of an eclipse of the moon that's coming one night. So without anybody else knowing about it, he, middle of the night, he sounds the drums rolling, sounds the, what they call the long roll, which is the men are to fall in line and prepare for action. So nobody knows what's going on. Everybody falls out of snow on the ground, fall out of the tents, running around, getting their gear, getting their rifles, lining up. They don't know what's going on. For all they know, there's an enemy force approaching. He marches them out into a field, and as the eclipse begins, he says, "Boys, there's an eclipse." And, you know, of course, half the guys are laughing, half the guys are scratching their heads, and they're all, and they write about it afterwards. And they, you know, the opinion was divided on whether people thought this was a good joke or they were upset because they'd been fooled. But this, you know, it shows, it's an insight into the kind of character Stone had, you know, kind of perhaps you might even say fun-loving. Certainly, it showed, it desensitized the men to that kind of emergency feeling. It was probably a good exercise in pulling them out and forcing them to focus and learn to prepare themselves quickly and unexpectedly for action. I'm sure that's part of what he had in mind. You know, another time, in a snowy day, he sets up the men, divides them into two groups, puts the regimental banner in the middle of a field, has the two men separated, two groups of men separated, and says, "Okay, snowball fight to capture the banner." And the two sides go at it in a snowball fight for a couple of hours. Again, the men writing about it years later said, you know, it was basically what we would call a team booster, a morale builder, right? They remembered it fondly. It was one of the memorable incidents of their time together. You know, that's the kinds of thing he did. Another member of the regiment writing years later remembers that a bunch of contraband whiskey was confiscated at one point when they were in Missouri. Stone has the men assemble, line up, march up one by one, and each got a glass of whiskey. You know, a nice kind of gesture, I think, and again, probably much appreciated by the men who didn't have many comforts like that in the field. So, again, an insight into the kind of commander Stone was, into the how his mind worked, and kind of how he endeared himself to the men over time. Now, you know, the regiment is for several months through March of 1863, from late 1862 to March of 1863, they're doing this rather dreary service in mid-Missouri, guarding, you know, commissaries and riding trains back and forth to keep them free from attack. I mean, this is really awful and boring, dull service, and men are getting sick. Eventually, and fortunately, the regiment becomes attached to General Grant's army, which is beginning to make an aggressive movement on Vicksburg. And here's where Stone's military story really takes off. For much of this time, he actually acts as a commander of a brigade of three or four regiments. So he's moved up into higher command for some of this time, and acquits himself fairly well for a man with no particular military training. He does a fair job. He's an organizer. He's intelligent. He keeps track of what he needs to keep track of, moves the men well. The high point of the 22nd Iowa service, if you could say that, certainly the dramatic time of their service, is on May 22nd, 1863, when the regiment, the 22nd Iowa, is involved in a direct assault on the defenses of Vicksburg. And they actually are in the lead of this attack along their section of the line. And alone, among all of the Union regiments that participated in the assault on that day, the 22nd Iowa was the only unit to actually breach the Confederate defenses and hold a portion of the Confederate line for a period of time. Lacking reinforcements, they have to fall back. Eventually, they suffer horrible casualties, close to 80%, in fact, a little over 80% casualties in the assault, killed, wounded, and missing. Stone himself is shot in the arm and pretty badly wounded during the assault, and is forced to the rear and eventually forced home. This And this is marks the real beginning of his political career for various reasons, is at that point in time.
Wow. And so what happens next?
Well, he goes home to recuperate. He has political ambitions. I think that's pretty clear. You know, he would deny that, but this is an ambitious guy with an interest in what's going on. He's had a taste of it through his work in the Republican Party. He's by now known to President Lincoln, a supporter of President Lincoln's. He goes home, and he's, again, the war hero, come home, his arms in a sling, suffered a brave wound at the front of his troops, leading this desperate charge. He goes home, and there's an election going on. There's to be an election that year for governor, and the Republican nomination is up for grabs, and the Republican convention is going on. So he arrives back in Knoxville. He understands kind of what he's been, I'm sure, informed all along by his friends at home what's going on. In June 1863, the Republican convention in Des Moines is scheduled. Now, there are two leading candidates for the Republican nomination for governor of Iowa, including another general who had actually been a commander of Stone's earlier in the war. The two leading candidates, the two known candidates at that time, are neck and neck. They're involved in a bitter dispute. One of those candidates makes the mistake at the convention of delivering a partisan speech that attacks his opponent. So the atmosphere becomes kind of embittered. Stone shows up at the convention, again, in uniform, because he's still active duty, his arm in a sling. He is invited to speak and makes a speech that is devoid of partisanship, that is dedicated to honoring the soldiers in the field, not saying anything about himself. He doesn't need to. You know, he's in uniform. He's obviously wounded. You know, he cuts a wonderful figure. He's a tall, good-looking guy. The convention realizes, well, here's our man. And by the next day, the two other candidates are canceling each other out, and the supporters of those candidates, as a compromise, begin to throw their support to Stone for the nomination for governor. He accepts it, runs that fall in the general election against a Democrat. Now, at this point in the war, Democrats having a hard time. They're perceived to be the opposition party opposed to the war, and in fact, a fair number of Democrats were actively opposed to the war and actively opposed to the war effort. We might call them the most vociferous of them. We'd call copperheads. Stone capitalizes on that, vigorously attacks them as disloyal, ends up winning the election basically in a landslide. He becomes governor in late 1863. His elected governor is inaugurated the following year.
Was he a good governor?
He followed a very popular and very effective governor, Samuel Kirkwood. He comes into office following up this beloved governor who had declined to run for a third term, and typically Iowa governors at that time would serve two terms and then leave office. On balance, I think he was a reasonably good governor. He had, you know, three kind of main issues during that time that he served, one of which was the threat in southern Iowa from folks coming over the border from northern Missouri. So that was an issue, obviously a security issue that he had to meet and attempted to do so. One of the other issues was the fact that there were still these draft calls the President Lincoln was making to enlarge and replace the men in the Northern armies. So you had this constant need to recruit more men, and if they couldn't be recruited as enlistees, they'd need to be drafted, which was an issue of itself. And also, one of the issues that he faced was, again, this continuing, at least perceived threat of disloyalty from these so-called copperheads who were believed to be undermining the war effort and actively working in, perhaps even in conjunction with Confederate authorities. I think Stone took that threat more seriously than a lot of others did, I think he overstated how disloyal the Democrats were. And there were plenty of loyal Democrats. So, you know, the idea of the loyal opposition certainly was in force there. You know, he'd go around and make speeches against them, warn people to be on the lookout and to work against them. But that was an issue that he faced. He also had to convince Iowans that they needed they needed to continue to meet the manpower calls that were coming out from the federal government. As the war went on, this became, you can imagine, there were fewer and fewer folks who were willing to jump in and join the armies. War weariness and would of course set in at some point, and even at one point, Stone had to send. This is in early 1864. Had to send troops to the western border of Iowa to keep people from kind of drifting out of the state towards the unsettled western areas, just to make sure that these folks would stay and not avoid military service. That was another kind of issue that he faced. Clearly, the war consumed Iowa for his first term as governor, and that was the period of time that the war continued, and during that time the war ended. Ultimately, he was successful in avoiding a draft for Iowa troops. The state was able to meet its manpower demands with only a small number of men having to be drafted. So to that extent, I guess you'd say he was successful.
Not very many people in Marion County and Knoxville know very much at all about Governor Stone. But one of the things that I keep hearing is that he was with President Lincoln when Lincoln was shot by John Wilkes Booth. Is there any evidence to that?
Yes, there are contemporary records that state he was in Washington at the theater, at Ford's Theater that night. There are some secondary sources I found that say he actually was involved in carrying the president out from the theater across to the Peterson House across the street where the president later died. I haven't found any reliable primary source for that. There are some sources that indicate he was in Washington that day and even at the theater. It traveled from Washington on the president's train back east as well. I haven't found support for the idea that he was actually directly involved in caring for the president after the president was shot.
Well, that's a great story, though, isn't it?
Well, it's wonderful, and I hope someday to nail that down. It's got to be out there somewhere. Certainly, we have reason to believe that he was in Washington, perhaps even at the theater that night. Which would not be surprising. As I said, he was a friend of Lincoln's politically and also, it appears, personally, certainly a supporter. So that certainly would make sense. Which brings us back to the other kind of connection historically that Stone has with the Lincoln administration, which is that because he's in Washington in 1864 during the Republican convention for the nomination of the president. Of course, President Lincoln's renominated. Stone is not there as a delegate. He's there as a kind of an observer with the Iowa delegation. And this brings up echoes of what he did in the 1860 nominating convention, except this time it involves the nomination of the vice president, Andrew Johnson. There's some discussion now about whether Abraham Lincoln wanted to renominate his existing vice president, who was Hannibal Hamlin from Maine, or whether he wanted to replace Hamlin with a war Democrat. There's evidence either way on that. Most historians believe that Lincoln wanted to replace Hamlin with someone who was perhaps more useful to the ticket as a symbol of unity and get a war Democrat or even a Southern Democrat, loyal Southern Democrat on the ticket. In any event, Stone, for his part, supports the candidacy of Andrew Johnson and supports Johnson's nomination for vice president. So at a critical point in the convention, Stone is able to there's a discussion about who's going to be nominated. the first ballot is taken for vice president. There's some back and forth, and it's not clear. Lincoln has not made any statement about who he wants. It was not untypical for that time. He's letting the convention decide, at least nominally. But so the first ballot is taken. Governor Stone jumps to his feet and says, Iowa casts its votes for Andrew Johnson. Now, first of all, he had no authority to do that. He wasn't officially part of the delegation. Second of all, not all the Iowa delegates supported Andrew Johnson. But at that point, it creates a tumult in the hall. Again, echoes of the 1860 convention. He creates a momentum that helps lead to other delegations throwing in their support for Andrew Johnson and leads to Johnson's nomination. And of course, again, kind of a turning point of history there, as we know, as Johnson became president just within a year. Hannibal Hamlin's grandson, who wrote a biography of his grandfather, very squarely blames Stone for the fact that Andrew Johnson was nominated for vice president in place of his grandfather. And there's certainly some historical record to support that.
Do you consider Stone one of Iowa's more prominent historical figures?
Absolutely. He clearly was. Not merely, of course, for his war record, although that would certainly be an interesting story. He was a war governor at that critical point in history. He was an early leader in the Republican Party at that critical point, associated with Abraham Lincoln. The drama of the wartime magnifies importance and magnifies prominence, and I think Stone, in that time and place, put himself in a position where he was a vigorous and, I think, effective leader. You'd have to consider him, I believe, one of the important Iowans of 19th century, and certainly someone whose career is worth studying and exploring.
Well, and what happened to him after he was governor?
He retires from the governorship. He doesn't retire from life. He's a fairly young man at this point still, and relatively in his 40s. He ends up eventually serving a term in the state legislature and active in politics and continues his law practice. When Benjamin Harrison is elected president in 1888, thereafter, Stone is appointed an assistant commissioner for the General Land Office in Washington, and near the close of President Harrison's term is actually promoted to commissioner. As Harrison's term ends, Stone leaves office and moves to Oklahoma, actually, which was then being settled, kind of a land of opportunity. He lived there at the time of his death in 1893.
And he's buried in Knoxville today.
He is buried in Knoxville, correct.
Wow. So he decided to finally come home.
He did. And there's a nice monument there with a plaque noting his service as governor and a fitting memorial to this individual.
Can you sort of sum up how you would recommend or suggest that we who live in Marion County and Knoxville now, how should we best remember him?
Well, I go back to the words that Alan Schroeder wrote, those perhaps somewhat condescending words, that this was not a man who was a brilliant statesman or philosopher. He was a fellow who found out where people were going and rushed out in front to lead them. I don't take quite that dim a view of Stone. I think that's always a part of political leadership. I agree that Stone was not a major philosophical force in the Republican Party or in Iowa politics, but he was, at a time when vigorous and active leadership was needed, he provided it. He proved his worth on the battlefield in that test. He inserted himself into the politics of the time. He seized opportunities when he saw them, and he provided effective and dynamic leadership at a time when it was needed. I don't criticize him for not being a philosophical leader. You know, sometimes you need men of action, and he was that man at that time who combined his own ambition with his own dynamic personality and created a record for himself. And I think that's how folks in Marion County and throughout the state should remember him.
With pride.
Oh, absolutely. He was not a perfect man. There are certainly elements of self-interest and self-aggrandizing in his background, but that's political life. You know, he promoted himself and his opportunities. I don't believe that's a reason to censor him, and I certainly feel that as a story, this is one that's worth telling, both in terms of what he provided as regional leadership and his time on the national stage. The Civil War in that time is full of interesting stories, men and women both, you know, grand and cowardly and everything in between, and Stone falls in the ranks much closer to the former than the latter.
Thanks to Jeffrey Burden for contributing to the program.
For KNIA KRLS News, this is Dr. Bob Leonard bringing you today's news and information in depth from our little corner of the universe.
An audio copy of today's in-depth program is available at KNIAKRLS.com on demand or for download. Just click Radio Plus. If you have topics or show ideas you'd like to hear in depth, contact KNIAKRLS by sending an email to Bob Leonard at KNIAKRLS.com. The one to count on for today's local news and the number one news and information source in Marion County is KNIA KRLS.